Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 19. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, Rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene.
If the Christmas story is all about Jesus and his birth, then the text that Tony read a few moments ago is the last piece of that story. It's related to the wise men and their visit earlier in Matthew chapter 2. You'll recall that their visit to Bethlehem stirred up the jealousy of King Herod. He was worried about this rival child king, and so he encouraged the wise men to come back when they'd found him so that he too could go and worship the child king. Well, after the wise men found Jesus, they were warned of God not to return to Herod and to slip out another way. Here's what Matthew 2:16 says. When Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth. I love that King James word. We don't use it anymore today, but I like it. He was exceeding wroth. And he sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and all the coasts thereof from 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had diligently inquired of the wise men. And that passage is the reason that we think that Jesus was no longer an infant when the wise men showed up in Bethlehem. While the shepherds visited him the very night of his birth, it appears that the wise men visited him maybe a year, maybe 2 years later. It's also interesting that the shepherds visited him in a cattle stall. The wise men visited him in a house. When Herod determined he would kill all the baby boys in Bethlehem, God warned Joseph in a dream. Joseph took his little family and fled to Egypt. And then when he heard that Herod had died, he packed up his family and made his way back to Nazareth. It'd be really interesting to know how old Jesus was when they made their way back to Nazareth. The Bible doesn't say. We can only speculate. Most speculation ranges from somewhere between 2 and 4 years of age. Doesn't matter, and we really don't know. But a lot had happened to Mary and Joseph in those few years. I mean, just think about it. When this whole story started, they were just a young couple that were engaged, looking forward to starting their lives together like any other normal couple in Israel. And then things took an unexpected turn, didn't they? One day an angel appears to Mary and informs her that she's going to have a child. And you remember her initial response, how can this be, seeing I know not a man, I've never been intimate, how can I have a baby? And the angel said that the power of the highest will overshadow you, this child will be from God. And sure enough, she then is pregnant with the Christ child. And then Joseph, when he found out about this, was minded to put her away privately, which is what the text says. What it means is he wanted to sweep it under the rug and call it all off and go do his own thing. And then the angel appeared to him as well and assured him that this was God's doing, as if this were some normal thing that could happen to anybody. And then they found out they had to go to Bethlehem to pay their taxes. Mary was in no shape to travel to Bethlehem. Luke tells us in chapter 2 that she was great with child. And given the travel arrangements for that time, she had no business traveling, but she would be by her husband's side, and this child had to be born in Bethlehem, and so they went. You know the story. In Bethlehem, there are no vacancies in the inn, so they put up in the cattle stall. And in that cattle stall, this little teenage bride. And we don't know how old Mary was. I've read speculation that says she was as young as 15, maybe 16 years of age. And that's probably accurate speculation. She's just a teenage bride, away from home, away from her support system, in a cattle stall, and she goes into labor and delivers her firstborn child. Moms, how would you like to have had your first child in those conditions? Now the baby was born. You'd think they could relax and catch up on some rest, but that wasn't to be. Because all of a sudden, you've got this ragtag band of shepherds who show up. And they have this wild tale. We were on the hillsides and these angels came and appeared to us in the night. And they said, this baby is born and you need to go see him. He'll be laying in a manger, wrapped in swaddling clothes. He'll be the son of the highest. And they just went on and on. And is this that baby? Well, so it was. And then they left, and Luke tells us that they told everybody they saw what they had seen and heard. And so you wonder how many interruptions they had that night in the cattle stall, when what they really needed was a good night's rest and to kind of begin to put things back together. For some unknown reason, Mary and Joseph seemed to have set up house in Bethlehem and stayed there. So that months later, they were disrupted again by a band of Eastern mystics who showed up at their door. Now, because these wise men brought three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, most people assume there were three wise men, but the Bible doesn't say that. And really, if you think about it, three men venturing alone across the Arabian desert with expensive gifts, that wouldn't have been very smart. Most scholars think there was an entourage of at least 100 of these people who showed up at Mary and Joseph's door. They must have looked at these strangers in their wealth with wide-eyed wonder, wondering what on earth is God doing. They left. Joseph had a dream. And in the dream, God said, Herod is on the rampage. Don't stay here. You've got to make your way down to Egypt. And so they did. And that brings us to the text. I'm going to read again the text that Tony read a moment ago. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in the dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, arise, take the young child, his mother, go into the land of Israel. They are dead, which sought the young child's life. And he arose and took the young child and his mother, came to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go thither. Notwithstanding, being warned of God in a dream, he turned aside to the parts of Galilee. He came and dwelt in the city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which is spoken by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. And that's the end of the Christmas story. That's the last piece. And it's also a beginning, isn't it? Because now they're done being on the run. Mary and Joseph move into whatever home they had in Nazareth. Now they can settle down and begin to live life as normal. Or maybe not so normal. Because the events of Christmas totally transformed their lives. Their encounter with the Christ of Christmas meant their lives would never be the same again. I want to show you three ways in which their lives would never be the same. First is their home would never be the same. Second is that their work would never be the same. And the third, I think their faith was never the same after the events of Christmas. Let's think about Christ and his home. Did you ever think about what kind of a child Christ must have been? What it would have been like to raise him? We really don't know because the Bible doesn't tell us. There are some apocryphal books out there that are interesting to read. There's one called The Gospel of St. Thomas that tells several alleged stories about his childhood. I find them fascinating reading. I don't believe a word of them, but they're interesting. A couple of my favorites are these. When Jesus and his playmates would make birds out of clay, what was really interesting is that Jesus' birds would come to life and fly away. How'd you like to have a friend like that? Ooh, Jesus, do it again, do it again. That's cool. I want you to show my mom and dad. Let's do this again. Another story is that Joseph was not a very good carpenter. And he once contracted to build a throne for the king. It took him a year to get it done. And finally, he delivers it and goes to install it. And wouldn't you know, he mismeasured. You know the old saying, measure twice, cut once. Well, nobody told Joseph. And it was too short. His client was the king. You don't do those kinds of things to the king. But Jesus stepped in and miraculously stretched the wood so it fit perfectly in the space it was to be in. Fascinating stories, aren't they? I don't believe a word of them. I just think they're fairy tales. I think there was much about raising Christ that was just like raising any other child. I don't know what they used for diapers in the first century. I'm pretty sure they didn't have Pampers. But whatever they had, Jesus wore them, and he had to have his diapers changed. You know, babies get up in the middle of the night, have to eat. I suspect Mary got up a few times and fed Jesus in the middle of the night. I mean, I'd like to think he was a perfect baby and within a week or so he's sleeping 8-9 hours. And maybe he did. I don't know. But they had to take care of him. They had to clothe him. They had to teach him. One question that's always puzzled me, and I've never found the answer because the Bible just doesn't tell us, is I wonder at what point Jesus began to realize who he was and why he came. See, what happened is when he became a man, according to Philippians chapter 2, he laid aside his divine prerogatives. And he literally became a man. Meaning that when he was an infant, he was an infant. What do infants know? Well, I guess they know what they feel. But they're blissfully unaware of their surroundings. And I just have to believe that Christ, because he became a real man, a human being, as he lay in that manger that night and those shepherds came and adored him, I think he's probably just oblivious to it. But at some point in his life as he grew, see, Luke chapter 2 tells us that he grew in wisdom and stature. So that tells us he wasn't born knowing everything. He was born as a man. And he grew in his wisdom. And at what point in his life did it dawn on him, you know, I'm different. I'm not just a man. I'm God. I'm on a mission. I came to pay for men's sins. I don't know. Have no clue when that consciousness came to him. In fact, the only biblical reference to Christ's childhood is in Luke chapter 2. You remember the story. Jesus was 12 years of age, and his parents took him to Jerusalem. And some say he went there for his bar mitzvah, and maybe that's why they went at that time. And Jesus hung out in the temple, and there began to discuss theological matters with the leaders who were there. And you remember the story. Mary and Joseph thought that he was another part of the family, and so they headed back to Nazareth and left Jesus behind. And that night, they discovered he's not with us and had to go back, and it took them 3 days to find Jesus. You remember where they found him? He's in the temple discussing theology with the religious leaders, and Luke says that all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. So where did Jesus, this 12-year-old boy, get such knowledge that it astonished the doctors of the law? Well, there may be two answers to that. Obviously, he was God in the flesh. And while in his humanity he started out needing to learn, because he was God, I suspect it didn't take him long to learn. I mean, if they had multiplication tables in the first century and he learned them, I expect he didn't have to review them very much. I mean, he had a divine mind. I mean, so, you know, that would have been a nice thing, wouldn't it? If he learned to read, and we assume that he did, it would have been unusual for the class that he lived in, but we assume he read, or at least he heard the scriptures read. And I don't suppose he had to have them repeated over and again. He was God. He would have retained those things and remembered those things. That was part of it. I also think part of the reason he astonished people with his wisdom was because of how his parents had raised him. God knew what he was doing when he chose Mary and Joseph to be his earthly parents. When you read, I think it's in Matthew chapter 2, it's known as the Magnificat. This is Mary's song. When she was told that she was going to have a child, she broke out in song. And one of the opening words is in Latin is Magnificat. That's why it's called the Magnificat. But if you would read through that sometime and count the number of scriptures that she quoted spontaneously from her heart, you would come to understand that this young woman had a grasp of the scriptures that puts most of us to shame. They understood the scriptures. They understood the demands of the law. And I suspect they fulfilled the demands of the law. Here's what the law says to parents. These words which I command thee this day shall be in your heart. You will teach them diligently to your children. God's word said to Mary and Joseph, you will teach these things diligently to your children. Their first child was Jesus, wasn't it? It's a safe guess to say that they taught these things diligently to him. The passage from Deuteronomy goes on to say, you'll talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lay down, when you rise up. In other words, you're to turn your home into a little theological seminary, and you instill in your children an understanding of God and his word. You talk about it all the time. I'm guessing that's the kind of home that Jesus grew up in. The difference is this. The teachers, Mary and Joseph, soon became the taught. Didn't they? As this precocious God-man who lived in their house took the scriptures they were giving and said, you know what I think that means is, and I suspect his parents sometimes just dropped their jaw. So where did he get that? How does he know that? But see, they did their part, and they taught him. And their home was never the same because of their encounter with Christ at Christmas. Would it be a stretch for me to suggest that because of the Christ of Christmas, our homes should never be the same? That maybe God would desire that we turn our homes into the little theological seminaries where the topic of choice that dominates our conversation is God and His Word and what God has done and is doing for me today. See, the problem with the way we celebrate Christmas is we pack it all into these 3 to 4 weeks leading up, you know, from Thanksgiving to now. And it all climaxes next Saturday on December 26th. We have our songs, we have our traditions, we have our gifts, we have our family gatherings, all this stuff we do. And all of a sudden, next Saturday evening, it's done. And we box it all up and put it away. And go back to normal. See, I just don't think Mary and Joseph boxed it all up and put it away and went back to normal. And I think neither should we. Reminds me of an old Charlie Brown cartoon. Lucy comes to Charlie Brown and says, "Merry Christmas! Since it's this time of the season, I think we ought to bury past differences and try to be kind." And Charlie Brown says, "Why does it just have to be this time of the season? Why can't it be all year long?" Lucy looked up at him and said, "What are you, some kind of fanatic?" Would it be fanatical to say that Christmas, the events of Christmas, should change our homes all year long? Not that we're wrapping up gifts and doing all that jazz every week, but that the Christ of Christmas permeates our homes and our lives and our conversation, and it's the focus of all that we do. That would be a Christmas celebration that would truly honor God. Because of Christmas, Mary and Joseph's home was never the same. I told you there were three things. Here's a second. Because of Christmas, their work would never be the same. Their mundane workaday world must have taken on a brand new significance because everything they did now was done for the Son of God who lived in their home. Their work was now an offering to God. Think about this for a moment. When Joseph went to work to put food on his table, who was he feeding? He was feeding God. Because that's who Jesus was, isn't it? When Mary did those daily chores, when she cleaned her house, when she made meals, when she mended clothes, she was mending clothes for God. Because that's who her son was. And that's not heresy, folks. That's sound Orthodox theology. Jesus Christ was God. And now everything they did in that home, they were doing for God. Wonder how our lives might change if we embrace their perspective and understood that everything we do really is to be done for God. See, Paul wrote to the Colossians in chapter 3 and verse 23, he said, "Whatsoever you do," and that's pretty broad, isn't it? I think it means whatever you do, right? I mean, this isn't hard to understand. "Whatsoever you do it heartily." Now catch this next phrase. "As unto the Lord." Whatever you do it like you're doing it for God. Now what's interesting about that Colossians passage is that Paul was writing to slaves. He wasn't just writing to run-of-the-mill people, he was writing to slaves. That was verse 23. Verse 22 says this, "Slaves, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, slaves, do it heartily as to the Lord." It's quite a command, isn't it? If Paul's expectation was that slaves should do their tasks as if they were doing it for the Lord. What's that say about you and me? I mean, suppose slaves were ever told to do things that they thought were ridiculous, that maybe they felt were demeaning, maybe below them. What Paul says, when you do those things, you do those things as if you're doing them for the Lord, because you're doing them for the Lord. I don't think we have any slaves in this room. People have jobs. When you go to your workplace tomorrow, what Paul is saying is, you do that job as though you're doing it for the Lord. If you're in a home with those children, you interact with those children as if you're interacting with God. You take on responsibilities for those children as though you're serving God. A couple days after my mother died, a month ago, I was sitting in my little office working on her obituary. I got a call, and somebody wanted to know how I was doing, how I was coping, how I was dealing with all of this. Writing the obituary was kind of a bittersweet experience. I mean, it was sweet because of the memories that I could remember. It's bitter because they're just now memories. And I said, well, you know, I write a little bit, and I cry a little bit, and I write a little bit, and I cry a little bit, but it's really been therapeutic. Because it's given me an opportunity to work through my emotions and my feelings and so many good memories about my mom. And I remembered something I hadn't thought about in years. I told this story at her funeral. And if you saw it, then you get to hear it again. But my mother, when she was a young mother, she had three little boys, 5 years or younger, 5 years of age or younger, which is just another way of saying she had her hands full. But she wanted to serve the Lord. And she was kind of torn because she wanted to be involved in the church, doing lots of things, but these boys just occupied her time and distracted her from what she thought she ought to be doing in terms of ministry. She felt guilty about it. So she went to see her pastor. His name was Joe Porter, a godly prince of a man. And she poured out his heart to him, and Brother Joe looked at her when she was done, and he said, "Sister Jean, God has given you those three little boys. Those three little boys, they're your mission field." And it changed my mother's perspective. All of a sudden, she realized that when she did things for those three little boys, she was really serving God. And see, I had the privilege of growing up in a home where that was my mom's perspective. We were her ministry. That's the perspective God wants all of his people to have. That's the perspective Mary and Joseph had. When they served that boy, they were serving God. When they did their job, they were serving God. Because of the Christ of Christmas, their job was never the same. I came across an old story about a devout man. His name was Anthony. And someone told him there was another man down the road who was maybe more devout than him. Well, that got his attention. So he sought him out. The other man was a cobbler in the other town. Anthony found him, and in his conversation, he said, "Tell me, what's the secret of your devout life?" And the man said, "I don't have a secret, but I'll tell you what I do. I make shoes. And every shoe I make for Jesus Christ." I wonder about us. I have a job. I don't make shoes. I make phone calls. Can I say that every call I make for Jesus Christ? I answer emails. Can I say that every email I answer on behalf of Jesus Christ as though I represent him? Mary and Joseph could, because they knew the Christ of Christmas. And because they encountered him, their work life was never the same. Their home was never the same. Their work life was never the same. And the third thing I want you to know is this: their faith was never really the same. They really went through some times at that first Christmas, didn't they? I mean, first that angel appears to Mary and says, "You're going to have a baby." I mean, the angel, that's a big deal by itself, but that message, whoa. And then the angel appears to Joseph and says, yep, that's God's baby. You're going to take and raise my son. God provided for them while they were in Bethlehem. God warned them of the wrath of Herod, took care of them in Egypt. God gave them directions when they were to go back to Nazareth. God did a lot of things for them. And I think those things, those experiences, became an anchor for them that they could always look back on and say, look what God did. I will trust him. Maybe we assume that Mary and Joseph had it comparatively easy, and I think that would be a wrong assumption. And they got back to Nazareth, and you got to know there were rumors flying around about them. Did you know that she was pregnant before they got married? Did you know they ran off to Bethlehem to have that baby? Because nobody in Bethlehem would know them. Can you imagine the rumors? See, the fact is, Joseph and Mary knew the truth. They knew what God had done for them, and they held on to that. Here's an interesting thought. The last time we see anything about Joseph in the New Testament is Luke chapter 2. That was when Jesus was 12 years old in the temple. And he disappears from the pages of Scripture after that. I wonder why. Well, we don't know. Scholars speculate that he probably died an untimely death. Well, if that's the case, then Mary was a single mom, wasn't she? Not just to Jesus, but she had at least four other sons, Joseph and James and Simon and Judas, maybe a few daughters as well. Here's this little single mother. How's she going to make it? Well, she held on to her faith. She knew what God had done in those early days, and she anchored her life to what God had done for her. Here's another interesting thought. You know how old Jesus was when he began his ministry? 30 years of age. You remember what the angel told Mary? You'll call his name Jesus because what? He'll save his people from their sins. What was he doing till he was 30 years old? Well, according to Mark 6:30, he was a carpenter. Carpenter, really. So until he's 30 years of age, he's working in a carpenter shop. But the angel said he will save his people from their sins. What's he doing in there that's going to save anybody from anything? Think there was ever any doubt in Mary's mind? Think she ever wondered about the mysterious ways of God? God, what are you doing? This boy should be in seminary. He ought to be preparing for ministry. And he's in there working as a carpenter. She knew what God had done for her. And I think she just rested in that, knowing that he knew best. Oh, they went through some hard times. They went through mysterious times. But the Christ of Christmas sustained them through those times. Many of us may experience difficult times in the days ahead. Some of you may already be there. Loss of a job, loss of a loved one, disappointing experience. You're watching inflation eat away at your income. It's not as easy to buy groceries, not as easy to fill your car up with gas. These are challenging times, aren't they? The Christ of Christmas does not eliminate the difficulties from our life. Didn't eliminate difficulties for Joseph and Mary. What he does is he gives us the strength to get through those difficult times as we trust in him. The story of Christmas comes to an end at the end of Matthew chapter 2. But its impact continued throughout the lives of Mary and Joseph. Here's my challenge for you today. Next Saturday, it all comes to an end. When we meet again next week, Christmas will be done. And you'll be boxing up your stuff. You'll be moving on with life. But don't go back to life as normal. Let the Christ of Christmas influence your home. Let the Christ of Christmas influence the way you do your job. Let the Christ of Christmas be the focus of your faith. So with whatever the new year holds, your confidence, your trust is in him. Let's pray together. And Father, I thank you for the reality of the story of Christmas. Thank you that it's a true story. And thank you for the way it impacted the lives of Mary and Joseph. May we experience that as well. Because of Christ and Christmas, may we not just go back to life as normal. May we allow you to impact our homes and our jobs and our faith. May we serve you better for the glory and honor of Jesus Christ, in whose name I pray. Amen.